listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favorite authors.
We've got a very exciting podcast for you today. We are joined by author extraordinaire, John Larkin. John, good morning.
Morning, thank you.
John, a little bit of backstory about you, and this is the first thing that drew me, obviously, is the fact that you began life as a professional soccer player.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I've just come back from a week in Melbourne doing talks at schools, and then when they do my bio, when I'm being introduced, you can see the boys all looking like kind of bored because it's going to be an author talking. And then when they say, this is the boys at the back, you know, the sporting boys, when they say, John used to be a professional soccer player, all their ears prick up and suddenly I develop credibility, not because I write books, because I chased a bag of air around a field and got paid for it.
Now, I'm just going to briefly nerd out here. This is going to be my nerd out moment linking into that, which That's is right. Two things. One, what position?
I was a winger. That was my preferred position.
I'm a goalkeeper, so anybody who's no goalkeeper is not a player.
Okay.
And secondly, far more importantly, which team do you support?
Do I support? Actually, I must admit, I'm a bit of a purist. I just like watching the game for the game. I'm not one of those guys who can sit on the lounge watching a game wearing a scarf.
So I wear a scarf.
I'd like to see that, John.
But I think that's not a bad answer.
Yeah. I just like the World Cup because the men are really good looking.
Not sure.
Oh, really? Okay. No, I can't say I've crossed it.
Can't say you perused that part of the thing.
No, I watch it for the game, not for the tightness of the shirt.
Let's bring it back to your strong suit. So,
right.
So now, obviously, in preparation, the fact that it says you were bitten by the writing bug while sitting in a cafe in Paris reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah.
There's so much of that that I think just makes perfect sense for everybody on the planet. But why Hitchhikers?
Well, it was a kind of strange story in that I wasn't a reader at school, but I became a reader post-school because I think as a professional athlete or a semi-professional athlete, you have a lot of downtime. Mm. So I took up reading, and it was just thrillers. Like, I'd be on a long coach ride, and I just started reading thrillers and things like that. So it wasn't really literature per se because I wasn't at uni or anything like that. But I was over in England trying to make it over there, and I hyperextended my knee. And and my career was kind of over as a professional athlete. And so, but I was lying in hospital and my sister sent me a series of books, and it was The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And then I was a bit ambivalent at first, but then I started reading them. I thought, wow, this is so, it was like, I felt like I was having my brain massaged with words.
It's always about finding the right book though, because I hear that a lot from authors that they weren't really into reading and they just found the right book and that's what led them down the path.
Yeah. That's it. You just need, and that's what I do as a guest speaker now. I just try to connect. I mean, like the students who are into reading, they connect with you already, but I try to connect with that boy at the back. You may be a bit lost, and if you turn him onto the right book, you've got a reader for life. And so that's what happened to me.
And I think that just generally as well, you hear that people like Adams are quite often the ones where people go, that was the book that hooked me. And Douglas Adams gets a lot of credit, I think, from a lot of writers and authors. And I think it is that engaging way that he sort of addresses things that makes you think about things, as you said, in a different manner.
That was it. And it was his use of concept, use of words that I'd never thought about before. Like, I do remember, I'll paraphrase my favourite quote, the ugly yellow Vergon ships hung in the sky the same way the bricks don't. What just happened to my brain? I think it messed over in a good way. And so
you do have to spend some time processing all of what Adams is writing there.
Yeah.
So, just on the biography before we get into it, since 93, over 22 books for children, teens, adults, everyone basically.
Multiple awards.
Everybody, lots of awards, lots of words written there, lots of talks given, as you mentioned. We'll talk about that a little bit later too. And today the ones we're going to be addressing, we're going to be dealing with The Pause and the Shadow Girl. I'm not going to be one of those people who starts off or asks that question of which is your favourite book you've ever read. That's a horrible question to ask.
Right.
But in your writing, is there one theme that you found that made you sort of more prolific with a series of books, perhaps, rather than just a book you loved and that was what drew you in?
No, I guess I always find the humour in things, and so my focus has been on humour, the same as Adams. That's probably why I connected to him. But then when I came across the Shadow Girl story, I didn't know if I could do it justice because it was based on a true story. Excuse me. And so I really let that story pop, you know, just let it percolate away for a while. And then eventually I actually was doing my PhD at Sydney University, and my supervisor, I chatted to her about the novel I was contemplating, and she actually said, look, stop your PhD and get onto this novel that needs to be written. And so, yeah, so
his
supervisor saying, don't do a PhD. And she's right. Well, what the heck am I doing a PhD for? So airline upgrade, maybe. That's all I'm going to do with it.
Yeah. Okay, so you could take that one of two ways. You could take that with, you know, your talents, you really need to write this novel, or you could take that as her looking at your PhD and going, No, don't write this. Yeah. Don't write this. Do something else.
Yeah, I felt there was an element of that.
Come on.
Yeah, go away and do this. Do something else. So, yeah, I guess my heart wasn't in a PhD. I didn't aspire to a career in academia, so I'm not entirely sure why I was doing it, other than to say, look at me, aren't I clever? I've got a DR in front of my name.
And that's a valid reason, by the way.
Yeah, it wasn't enough to spend 3 or 4 years on, though. So,
yeah, that's on your life on it.
Yeah, so now I'm waiting for the honorary doctorate. So,
yeah, that'll come, I'm sure.
Yeah. You get a really good hat and cap and gown with that normally, too. Much better than actually graduating.
Easier, too, I think.
Yeah, you do. So, if anyone's out there want to give a multi-award winning author a honorary doctorate, I'm all ears. So.
John's your man.
Yeah. We'll set that up. We've got connections.
We don't. Okay, The Pause. I loved The Pause. We're going to start with The Pause.
Okay.
It was a book about moments of joy, moments that are unbearable, and moments that are worth waiting for. And I love the quote, and isn't that life, little moments stitched together? How did this particular story come to you?
Well, it came to me via a nervous breakdown. I did... Have a complete mental breakdown. I spent several weeks in a couple of psychiatric hospitals being stitched back together, and The Pause was simply born of this time. Although when I did start writing it, what I noticed, though, when I was in the hospital, there was a lot of people in there, and Danny, you should be wary that most of the people in there were teachers, so yeah. I'll give you a heads up. So
I don't doubt that at all.
What I noticed about the guys who were in at the same time as me, they struggled to put into words what was happening to them, because it was quite evident to me, without sounding patronizing, that they weren't readers. And so they didn't really have the language skills to do sort of a meta-analysis of what was going on with them.
Yep.
And so I actually got to thinking, as I was recovering, I thought, you know what I want to do? I want to write a book, a self-help book for men about my age who don't read. And I thought, hang on, slight problem there. Your primary market is not a reader. So I let it percolate again for a while, and I thought, maybe I should tell this, because the people most impacted by suicide is teenagers. Well, teenagers and young adults, the biggest killer of our young people now.
And the males are 18, 24.
Yeah, it's suicide. It's no longer car accidents. So I thought, I need to write this book to, you know, say, stick around, you're worth it. And so that's how that came about.
And I think as well, you touched on it exactly right, the culture of men not being able to, and I'm not stereotypical here, because obviously I'm not with two men who are like this, you're very good with your words, but generally in society, men often find it very hard to put these things into words, and I think that makes it worse for them.
And also dealing with that idea, especially in those formative sort of teenage years, and how that masculinity can be portrayed or sort of twisted by the groups and the way that other people represent. And I think this is one of the reasons why this is kind of a really important thing to get out there, even if, as you said, your core group is not readers. But it is a very important message still, because you do see that in a lot in teenage years, especially of, I have this emotion, I can't express it.
Yeah.
Don't quite know how to get it out. Mm. And it will appear in either a physicality, or it just won't appear and will become something that sort of festers for a while.
It will appear exactly like Declan in The Pause. It comes out later. And I really like the quote, everyone's a bit nuts. We're just the ones who admit it. I can definitely relate to that.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the Are You Okay days and everything, it is putting it on the gender. And I think that's why a book like this is so important. I mean, you know, I myself, I suffer from anxiety that is sometimes debilitating. And I kind of got that from the novel that it was a really personal experience for you, because some of the things that I was reading, it was just too real and too familiar.
Well, look, you know, tell you what, despite the subject matter, it was the easiest book I've ever written.
Wow.
Because it just came pouring out, and all I had to do was keep an eye on the structure, and everything else just sort of wrote itself. In fact, I cannot actually remember writing this book. Seriously. I have no recollection. Well. Yeah, it's bizarre.
Like, writing is therapy. Like, it's my form of meditation, you know, just sort of gets you out of the world for a bit.
And a lot of the time, if you've been living a large element of the thought processes or just the general conceptual stuff there, it doesn't feel like it's something that actually is being produced. It just feels like, yep, that's existence.
Yeah, I think as a writer in that situation, in that fortunate situation, you're just really the conduit. The words just flow through you. And I was just passing my daughter, who's lying on the lounge now. She's trying to write her honours thesis, and she's going, "Oh, I can't write this, Daddy. I don't know what." I thought, yeah, it's a shame, because if she was in the mode I was in when I did the pause, it just, yeah. It's not even work. You just sort of look out the window and the words flow through you. It's kind of bizarre, but it's wow. So magical when it happens.
Yeah, that's amazing. It is a story as well, you know, about those dark issues and those very real issues, but it's also really obviously a story about hope, about relationships. As a mum, a particular mum of a son, I loved the relationship between Declan and his mother. And I really liked the idea of, you know, first I must heal, first I must reboot. And I thought the language of that was really sort of teen friendly, and it explains how one can move forward with mental illness. So how did you develop such an authentic adolescent voice? Was it from your own adolescent voice or your teenage kids yourself? Or
yeah, it was really me. I just pictured myself as being 17 again, and off I went.
We're all kind of 17 still in our heads, aren't we?
Oh, much.
Yeah, totally. And I didn't even get my – because I've got a bunch of teenagers. You know, I've got five children, and ranging from 14 to 21. And so even at the time, my eldest would have been – teenager, and so, but I didn't really have them authenticate it, really. I just did it myself, and then there was no question that I was able to get the language right. And it's not something I even thought about, because I suppose I'm around teenagers a lot, same as you, Danny. You know, we huge amount of work in high schools, and so you pick up the vernacular without stealing it. And yeah, exactly. Yes, I must admit, it was easy.
And one of the things that I found too, dealing with teenagers on a sort of daily basis, is that a lot of the time when you get people who also try to put that language then through, you know, a teenage filter, so to speak. So they craft what they think are teenage words, then go to a teenager and go, how does this sound? And get it rewritten. It then doesn't sound as authentic.
Yeah, that's true.
It's gone through that filtration process. And it also has gone through different teenage culture groups who have their own way of talking. And therefore, you don't get this uniform voice that you would get, even if it is somebody who's not necessarily a teenager, just thinking back and going.
Yeah, and teen language, it also changes too.
Oh, it's evolved on a daily basis.
Yeah, and so I think what you have to get right is the attitude, as opposed to the language. You get the attitude right, and you get the way they look at the world. And for me, it's quite easy, because I just regress to being a teenager.
Yeah, in our heads, we're always 20.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you where these came from. Like, I want to know, do you just sort of stop the car and have to pull over the car? Because there are some really light and funny moments here where I actually stopped and laughed out loud. And one of them was when Declan goes to meet the Kraken, and he says, it has her hand, all the warmth and texture of a three-day-old dead fish. I don't know whether to shake it or batter it and serve it with chips. How did you come up with that?
I don't know. I'm just going to sound, I don't know, sound arrogant. Those just things just happen to me when I'm writing, and I think, how far can I push this?
Oh, that's so great.
And so, yeah, look, those lines come to me all the time, and I don't have to pull over the car. I mostly take the train, so it's easier.
All right.
And so they're just able to sit in my brain for a while. And so quite often I just speak in similes. And
yeah. Well, I'm glad that they came out of your brain onto the page, because it was really enjoyable. And I particularly like this one as too. Had she left it any longer, she might have returned to find me nothing more than a pile of spat out bones and a couple of blinking eyeballs on the floor. The visual imagery for me was
I can
so
see it already.
Strong. And I just loved it.
Yeah. I know, just trying to relate to the Kraken, and like in that situation, Lisa left Declan alone with the mom, and she pretty much just ripped him to shreds visually. And he was trying to make a good, you know, you're trying to make a good impression. Yeah. to your girlfriend's mother or so forth, she sees right through you, and that's how it felt. And I thought, that's the way to express it. I think if you're like an owl, she'll chew him up and spit out the bones.
See, for me, I could just see like the Jim Henson Studio creating that.
Yeah.
And I could just see them cutting to this sort of pile of bones on the floor with the blinking eyeball.
I mean, show you the image for me. It's so clear. I really love it. It's actually probably really good lines to teach too when you're teaching writing.
It's interesting, yeah. I never really dwelled on that line too often. But yeah.
I really enjoyed it, so I jotted it down. And I love how they're juxtaposed with these really profound statements about mental illness, which really spoke to me from a personal perspective, as being human, it seems, is the greatest gift there is. It's also for some of us the greatest curse. And I just went, wow, you know, doesn't that speak to us so much? And mental illness is different. It leeches into your mind like a thief in the night. Like sometimes you just don't notice this coming on and it just hits you like a ton of bricks, I guess. Yeah. I really like the juxtaposition between those really hilarious language and the other things that made me reflect on, oh, yeah, this is really going on in my head too.
Well, I suppose, I just wrote the book naturally. I didn't sort of plan to do a funny bit here more a contemplative bit there. But I suppose I always keep in the back of my mind, I use humour to break things up, because if you write just a book about depression, anxiety, bipolar and whatnot, it gets a bit too heavy. So you've got to break it up occasionally. And
the other thing, really
conscious decision. I just noticed when I was in hospital, like my first night in hospital, I was told by the nurse that dinner was being served now and you could go along to the dining room, and it was just along the corridor. I remember walking along the corridor like a 90-year-old man because I had a complete breakdown. But I got into the dining room and there was all these women there, and they were all laughing their heads off about something that had happened in group therapy that day. And I was thinking, you know, why are you laughing? And I thought, well, if you're not laughing, maybe you're crying.
Yeah.
But then it's just one of those things that happen in a psychiatric hospital. There's great humour about, and that's life, isn't it? Even the sort of most depressed people can have a laugh, and that's pretty much true of mental hospitals as well.
That's exactly what I was about to sort of, you know, discuss with you as well. This idea of that, even in, you know, most people, when they've got that dark sort of space in their head, you still find, and I actually find, you find the more absurd things.
Yeah, absolutely.
More hilarious. It's that dark natural humor. Dark humor, yeah. Which, you know, I've heard John Cleese talk about dark humor. He often talks about when they were filming Fish Called Wanda. And when they were doing Fish Called Wanda, the scene where they run over Ken with the steamroller, Ken's running over with the steamroller. And when they played that to the first audience, they were worried about how badly that was going to play, because they were told to take that scene out. It was horrific. He's running him over with a steamroller. And he said, there's this moment of pause in the screening. And then the room just fell about with laughter. And it was the biggest laugh the screening got. And he said, because quite often in their mind in comedy, the genuine laughs, everyone laughs along with, and that's good. But the really deep guttural laugh is that dark humour where you don't quite know how to process it, but deep down something in your psyche still goes, that's hilariously absurd. And I think that's a lot of what happens in that mental health space too, is that the darker stuff becomes even funnier.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're absolutely right. And I suppose with a scene in Fish Called Wanda, had they killed him, had they killed who was it, Otto?
Yeah.
Had Ken killed Otto?
Yeah.
It wouldn't have resonated.
No.
When he came back on outside the window of the plane.
Exactly.
He was on the wing, and I think he was blown off, and he would have died there anyway.
Exactly.
You realised he wasn't killed by the steamroller. He was probably the
fourth. And then later on, that's a scene that you go, that was hilarious. Who runs someone over with a steamroller really slowly?
20 years later, we're still talking about
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
So that's it. That's good comedy, isn't it?
I also thought the idea of pausing was a really important motif in the novel, obviously, but in our increasingly busy world where, you know, busyness is kind of glamorised almost, I think it's really important for all of us to pause. And if we look at the mental health stats, they're just increasing, increasing, increasing. So how do we do it? How do we glamorize being still?
That's it. Like, when I got to the hospital and I was saying to the nurse, when can I get out? She was saying, you just got in. And she goes, what we need to do now is you have to take a step back and just, she didn't use the word pause, but she said it like, you have to just stop. You have to get off the treadmill of life.
Yeah.
Then be kind to yourself and say, listen, two, three, four, five, 6 weeks will pass and your life is not going to change that much on the outside, but you need to get better first. And I suppose
that's how I suppose people in the city process maybe being mentally ill. I've got to hurry up and get better so I can get back to my life.
Yeah.
And that's just the way that we are conditioned through our society.
And then get back to that stress again, and you never take that break. I mean, I feel it as a parent of two kids. You just can never get off that treadmill. But I find it so important to pause, whether it's through meditation or writing or walking or just pausing from that busyness of life.
And that would also be something I would suspect that you'd also been preconditioned with your footballing career, where, you know, when you get a knock, you take an injury, it's when can I get back? How can I get back faster? How am I going to be back on that field?
And it's the same with work. You just, you feel, I don't know what it is, my culture or whatever, you're off work, you hate being sick and you think you're letting people down, so you've got to get back quickly. And that's just the way that I think living in a city is. You're just driven to keep going, and then we're not kind to ourselves very often, but we need to be kind to ourselves.
Absolutely. We're looking at the mental health stats, so it's proof in itself that we need to be kind to ourselves. We need to pause. I need to take that on myself. Both novels, they touch on spirituality and politics, and they challenge religion. How would that come about for you? Was it just because of their position, the characters, both the Shadow Girl and the Pause, or was it something you were trying to comment on, that unpacking the different types of spirituality?
When I look at spirituality and religion, it's always I'm asking questions rather than delivering answers.
Yeah.
Because it's such a complex minefield. And I grew up a Catholic, and I suppose my whole moral basis was based on my upbringing as a Christian. But then I look, when you look at what too many priests and too many brothers had done to young boys and young girls, I got to thinking, you've lost the moral center. You've got no right now to be the upholder of morality in our society. Mm-hmm. And so we need to look elsewhere. Now, I would say right now I'm agnostic. My wife's a strong Christian, which is fantastic. We have the best discussions about it. Yeah, and it's not like, you know, it's not arguments, it's discussions, and they're really healthy discussions. And
because we're all seeking answers. It's none of us.
Yeah, really, I think you're right.
I think that's what I liked in The Shadow Girl. She says, you know, just as you said, I have so many more questions than answers.
And
I think
and that's me. And so she's just a conduit for my own exploration of philosophy, of faith, not so much organized religion. I must admit, I'm a little cool on organized religion, but I do attend church with my wife because she's very passionate about that. And of course, I'll go with her. It's the same as if she went to a Buddhist temple or a synagogue or a mosque. I'd want to go with her and just sort of explore that experience. But I think a novelist will write to understand what they're writing, if that makes sense. So the book's always an exploration of where we're going philosophically wise, faith wise, and so forth.
Something else I loved about the book before we move on to The Shadow Girl was just the non-issue of his mate Chris coming out as gay. And I just liked how it was just a little thing that happened that, you know, teenagers struggle with, but it was just a non-issue. And I thought, gee, wouldn't it be nice if society got to that place?
It would be nice, and maybe that was my little slap on the hand to society saying,
yeah, I liked it.
Process it. And it was no big issue for either of them. It was like, yeah, move on, carry on. What's the big deal?
That's also powerful, I think, about it, because it's only a minor part of the book, but I found that really powerful, their responses to it. And I think the book was, how can we do better for our adolescents? How can we get them talking about depression and anxiety, and how can we make them feel comfortable being themselves? And so that was what was really important for me as a
mother. The funny thing is, though, Danny, is that, you know, as a guest speaker, on the back of the Pause, I get invited to do a lot of guest speaking in schools and so forth. But I have been stopped no fewer than 5 times at the reception of schools by school counselors or principals who rarely deign to meet the lowly author. They've come and intercepted me at least 5 times now and said things like, oh, can you not talk about suicide? And my attitude is, you know, look, I'm pretty experienced in what I do. I sort of know how far to push it. I talk about an overarching mental health issue, and I just brush briefly on suicide because I understand the concerns. But once one group stopped me and I said, look, why don't you want me to talk about suicide? I only brush on it. And the principal said, because we had a year 9 boy attempt suicide last year and he's going to be in your talk. And I just said, he's exactly the boy I should be talking to.
Yeah.
And but there's this attitude of like, let's play it safe, let's not discuss it.
And this was something I think that became sort of really large, especially if you work in schools. It became really large around when Netflix then released 13 Reasons Why. Mm. And I can speak, I had a year 9 group. All they wanted to talk about for a couple of days was going through that and going through the issue.
I think that's incredibly empowering for them. And there were schools sending out notes to parents saying that now this show was on TV, we've got to watch out for copycats. They actually didn't believe there was going to be an epidemic of suicide around 13 Reasons. And it just did not eventuate, because if you talk about this issue, that relieves the safety valve, and kids are depressurizing because they're talking about it.
And we've been teaching it for years anyway. Look at Dead Poets Society. How long have we been teaching that? And Jasper Jones, you know, they all deal with those things as well.
Yeah, and I think that it's something that the not talking about it becomes a bigger problem than the actually discussing it. People, you know, myself included, have lost really good friends to things like suicide. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of the time it's they don't feel comfortable discussing it. They think it is this social taboo of I can't speak about that. I can't speak about having those thoughts.
And it's mainstream media too, Chris. Like The Paws won the Queensland Literary Award a couple of years ago. I thought I would get quite a bit of publicity on the back of that and through mainstream media. I got one interview with my local paper in Sydney, and they didn't want to talk about the topic of the book. They just want to talk about me, the author. The media just does not want to touch this. They'll touch it as an overarching mental health issue, but when you start talking directly about suicide, it's like they've adopted this sort of ostrich approach, I probably would call it, head in the sand. Mm.
Which is going against everything we've just said, isn't it, about being open and enabling people to talk and discuss.
Yeah, and that's one of the really important things, I think, about then having more discussions and doing these sorts of talks, which you do, is being able to sort of engage with the content. And it doesn't matter sort of what content it is. For an author, it's important to be able to engage with that content. Yeah. But especially with these broader themes that you do discuss in your books, you know, the philosophy side of things, the social aspects, as we said before, the character coming out as being gay and it being a non-issue, especially in the times we're at the moment with the social discussions going on.
Marriage equality.
It's important to be able to discuss those issues out front and open and make them not this taboo that means that people suffer in silence.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of a really important point. It's an important factor in the book.
Yeah. And I have a 5-year-old and I don't know, he's probably got it from me, let's face it, but he has to talk about his feelings in the shower every day. Mm. So I'm like, I don't think I continue this when he's 15. Maybe we'll change the location.
Coffee lounge.
Parents and children, I think no subject should be off limit.
My own kids, no topic is off limits. And even they're little, they're young, but we could still have these conversations. You know, I talk to my kids about marriage equality. Shadow Girl, let's move on.
Let's shuffle along.
I just want to ask you how you got into the head of a sassy teenage girl, John.
It's because I have a bunch of them. Okay. The girl who inspired the book was very real. Mm-hmm. I met her during the school talk, but I only met her for the one day. She was homeless and she lived on the trains by herself and she was year 8. But I only met her for the one day. I was doing talks and workshops at her school. But then I let the book percolate for several years before I tried to write it. But then because I had no recollection of the girl per se other than her appearance, I needed another character. So I just pretty much downloaded my own 15-year-old daughter, she was at the time, Chantel, who's now 21. So I gave her the sass. I gave her the attitude that my daughter would have in that same situation.
And don't daughters have sass? Wow, I have a 3-year-old already sassy.
Yeah. Oh, look, I must admit, my, because I have 3 teenagers, well, 121, and I have Gabby, who's 14, and Natalie, my wife's daughter, who's 17. But no, they're great without being too sassy, although they let fly at each other.
You need a bit of sassy. You need sassy. I'm just like, can't you be sassy with everyone else, just not with me? But it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I'm sassy back to them, so I think I get in the sassiness first.
You know, you're the test ground where all this sass develops. Yeah,
well, I have heard she's inherited the sass from me.
I wasn't going to say that, but yes.
Whatever. One of my favourite quotes, really early in the book, if I'd been a rat or a cat or a possum, she wouldn't have said anything, but I'm a human, so I'm not welcome. this line really spoke to me about what's, you know, society, what we value, and in the light of refugees in Australia.
Yeah.
And, you know, we should be ashamed that we're not looking after human beings. Were you making a comment on society, or you were just talking about possums?
No, I was just of course I was making a comment on society, yeah. Look, you know, we had this teenage girl living in an abandoned house. No one lived there. It was unloved. It was falling to bits. So she set herself up in a home there. And the neighbour got wind of it, and so she complained to the police. You know, of course, had she been an animal, it wouldn't have been a problem. But because she's human, she's not welcome. And that was a savage indictment on our society and the way that we do treat homeless people.
Said so much, you know, had so much power behind it.
Yeah, that was the intention. You know, keep it simple, but make this, hold a microscope up to society and say, we do stuff like this. We do it with our people who we are just abandoning on Manus Island, and it's an absolute disgrace.
You know, it was a line that made me stop. You know, I often pause when I read something and I have to think about it, and that was a line that made me pause and go, wow, like you said, put simply, and you could have such powerful discussions.
And we've seen it with things like Manus and even closer in Sydney with the recent sitting in the middle of the city with the homeless situation going on there.
Yeah, like homeless people have got to be somewhere, but it's just like we just don't want them here.
Exactly. You know, we must do something, just not with us.
Just not here, yeah. Just do it over there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the story deals with some really dark issues, even though, you do add that beautiful lightness to your stories as well. But this one story in particular deals with domestic violence and grooming and pedophilia and homelessness and rape and murder. So I know that this came from a real story, but where did all this other stuff come from?
The homelessness itself was hers, the girl who I met, but the backstory was entirely invented. I had to give her a strong reason to go on the streets, and so for a predatory uncle, unfortunately, as we all know, that most incidents of pedophilia, of grooming, does not happen through strangers. It happens within the family environment, and so that's what I wanted to bring to light, this grooming that was taking place within her own home through her predatory uncle. And it was like to tell girls and boys to watch out, not to be on guard, but just to be careful, because this groom behavior is it's so sly, it's so insidious that it sort of creeps up on you, and suddenly it's all over you and you haven't really noticed it happening. So that was it. So I just got her to be aware enough of what was taking place. And then she went out.
Needed to escape. Then it was really nice that she had all these positive experiences as well. And I liked, because, you know, she had those negative experiences with Tony and her father and the boys on the train. That was really, really awful. But then she finds kindness along the way. And I liked how there was that balance of, you know, she says, oh, not all men are terrible. And she meets, you know, the fish and chip guy who gives her extra scallops and takes care of her. And then Alistair and Marco. And so she meets these nice men as well. So there's this nice balance that not everyone is a misogynist fool. That there's kindness along the way. And I really liked how there were symbols of hope, you know, along with Dr. Chen and Miss Taylor and Cinderella. And readers find that hope and that survival, that basically people are good.
Yeah, I think that's a true reflection of our society too. I think if you struggle with something, like if you're a woman who's broken down the side of the road, you will get help. Mm-hmm. And I think people are generally good. I truly believe that. I could be naive, but I do think if you're in trouble, strangers will come to your assistance, as I go to the assistance of strangers myself. Yeah. And I think the way the media probably portrays the culture is that we're not like that. But in my experience, we are like that. So I wanted that to come across in the book, in that, yes, there was a seriously bad person through her uncle and her father, and to a lesser extent, her aunt, but everyone else was really trying to help her. Like the boys on the train, they could be any boy on the train. Most of them aren't that bad, but it does happen. I've witnessed it happen. What I was having a go at there was the men hiding behind their papers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It wouldn't come to her rescue. Now, I've seen that. I saw that firsthand, actually, on a train. I asked for some help to deal with some young men who were abusing this girl. I said, come on, guys, we can sort this out. And they hid behind their papers.
Yep.
And so I was on my own. I had a carriage full of guys who we could have dealt with it straight away, but instead I had to go into battle by myself and sort it out. And I came back up the stairs and I said, you guys are cowards. And they just kept hidden behind their paper.
Yeah,
but one guy had the audacity to look across at the guy and he smiled as if I was the nut job.
that you would hope that if it was one of their sisters or daughters or mothers or wives, you know, or even one of their sons in trouble, that someone would go to help them as well.
That's what I said to them.
Yep.
I said, what if that was your child?
But I think what you say in the idea of people being generally good, I think is something that, and I tend to come at this more from like a more sociology perspective and looking at those sorts of issues. And I do a lot of work with year 11 and 12 students doing society and culture and looking at the way that media portrays things. And I think, unfortunately, in this day and age, a large amount of the way that people are portrayed comes down to what sells. And what gets people watching TV shows, what gets people news broadcasts, and especially in things like the era of everyone going to online media and 24-hour news cycles, it's all about just eyes on the product. And a news bulletin full of really positive, good stories doesn't seem to sell the sensationalism like terrorism striking today. And then when you look at the story, there's actually no depth to the story. It's just a headline.
If you watch the news, you have a very skewed vision of the world.
Yes, and it's the clickbait. It's the clickbait nature of society nowadays, where a positive headline, and there's been lots of studies done on this, a positive headline gets a lower percentage of clicks than something that's sensationalised drama.
I can honestly say I stopped watching mainstream news for about a year now, and I can honestly say that I felt my anxiety reduced because of it.
Yeah, I don't watch it either for the same reason.
I can't remember the last time I watched a news bulletin.
And I just can't, because it's just this ridiculous view of the world. If I want my news, I go find it myself.
And what I also find, just on that note before we move on, I also find that I teach a lot of that with looking at those, and I use the word incorrectly, current affairs shows. I use those as teaching material, because you get students who don't watch these who then dip back in and go, you show them the stories and they go, that's just stupid. Really? That's not a story. But when people are in that cycle 24/7, they get stuck on that idea that people are horrible and everyone's out to get you. Whereas, as you said, by and large, in my experience too, people are genuinely good.
You have to believe that anyway. You have to, especially when you have children. You have to believe.
You have to believe.
You're bringing up in a world that's not too bad.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like the whole media thing is really worrisome.
It is.
And because my book, The Pause, is I've got documented evidence that it saved 3 lives. Now, of course, that gets no media coverage. But then you have that twit from the One Nation Party turn up into Parliament dressed in a burqa.
That was hideous.
She tried to prove it was a security issue, but nothing happened. Therefore, she disproved her own theory.
I thought what I found fascinating about that incident you were talking about was that it did actually end up almost proving your people are generally good point in that all sides within the parliament turned around and who don't get along on these issues in generally and condemned it.
It was just so typical publicity stunt of hers. So, like, I feel like she hasn't been in the news for a few weeks, and so she just had to get in there somehow.
It works. Look, we're talking about it. Yeah, we're talking about it, how stupid she is, because this woman clearly is so stupid she shouldn't be allowed out in public without adult supervision, and yet she does that, and suddenly the media's all over her. And I just think, you're going to get ignorance in society, but it seems like right now that ignorance has more of a voice than it's ever had. And that's, and I think with the issue with what she was trying to do, she's trying to castigate one group in society on the basis of their cultural adornments, in this case being the burqa. That's entirely the wrong approach. We want to embrace the Islamic community so that we realize it's not that you guys doing these things that these idiots are doing. It's an absolute marginalized group of your own culture, your own religion. So let's work together with this. Let's not castigate and marginalize every member of the Islamic community. Because I've been a guest speaker in Islamic schools, and I've got to tell you, those places are fantastic. So this is the wrong approach to you're really treating a member of a group of society like lepers. And if you do that, you're going to get more hatred coming out of that because they are being marginalised.
I had a discussion just yesterday about this with a group of Year 10 students, and we started talking about the 1967 referendum, and the last 20 minutes were about the marriage equality plebiscite because I was saying, it's that vote yes, you must do something for, not specifically read the question carefully, all of these elements. And the kids are going, but that's what's in the media right now. And I went, so what's the difference? One was binding and one's not.
Yeah.
But the fact that is that kids as well, back to this generally good idea as well, kids will also draw these parallels. And I think one of the things that you will obviously have seen in the books that you write and your target audiences is that I think a lot of the time people don't give children and young adults enough credit for picking up on these things.
Oh, absolutely. They're a smart bunch of people.
And I think that's what I like about your books. They talk about politics. They touch on philosophy and religion and spirituality because you haven't underestimated their ability to contemplate these things and to discuss these things and have opinions on these things.
Yeah, because like when I talk to teenagers after doing a school talk or something, they're incredibly intelligent. So I think it would be patronising not to discuss these issues with them because that's what the issues they want to talk about because they are so smart, smarter than a lot of adults, smarter than Donald Trump, for instance. Doesn't talk much, I suppose.
And one of those other issues in The Shadow Girl was about social class, and I really liked the idea of how you were talking about the imagery of ivy and saying that where there's ivy, there's affluence and there's less domestic violence, and maybe we should just go stick some ivy in these lower socioeconomic areas and they'll build some beautiful high-rise building. And I really loved that idea. I thought that was
I was hoping people saw it for what it was and think, is he serious?
Ivy would be good, the best. It'd be great ivy stopping all
there you go.
I'm going to Bunnings today and I'm going to just buy a bus full of ivy.
Yeah. You don't need social programs in South Central LA. You just need ivy.
That's what they're missing. You know, the Ivy League schools don't have domestic violence.
That's right.
It's not like they sweep that under the carpet at all. No.
You grew up in the western suburbs and I grew up in the western suburbs. So we have a really, I think, a real idea of the social class and
yes.
the difference. Yeah. Society about it. So
I'm a fob and a Westie. I was fresh off the boat and I'm a Westie. It's strike too, but I like to embrace my culture and my heritage, and I'm proud to be a Westie.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we need more of it. I went to Macquarie University and they were talking to me about, oh my goodness, you know, you grew up in the West. And I'm like, hey guys, we're all doing the same course at the same uni. Like, come on, what does it matter? And they're like, yeah, you're right. Before we wrap up, your process of writing, you talk a lot about doing years of thinking about these novels before you put pen to paper. Do you some free writing or some zero drafts before that, or does it really just sit in your brain?
Yeah, it's just percolating. I could probably have about 4 or 5 books on the go at one time, just percolating away, and then one will speak to me saying, this is the one to do now.
Yeah,
I always think it's important to, when I start a book, to finish it rather than a lot of young writers make the mistake, or a lot of first-time writers that will have they'll have what they think is a great idea and they'll start it, but then they'll lose confidence in that idea and they'll park it and they'll try something else. I think if you follow it through, so I always, when I start a book, I finish it. I have to do, because I always write probably the last line first. One of the first lines I write is the last line, so I know where I'm going.
I like that. And so how much does it change from your initial idea? So say if you do get into that stage where you're not believing in it anymore, what do you do? Do you do a rewrite? Do you change it? Do you just keep going?
If I'm struggling with like where the story's going, I'll just reread it and try and get into The Shadow Girl on the Pause. There was never any issues. I always knew where they were going. They didn't, like, for instance, The Shadow Girl didn't end. It ended in the same location, but it wasn't the last line that I intended to use, because in the original, in my thought process of The Shadow Girl, she was going to end the story in the church when everything's been resolved to a certain amount.
Yeah.
And then she was going to sort of bow before the priest like a good Catholic girl and say, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Now, then the feminist in me came out and said, we cannot have this young lady who's been through so much and she survived and she's been so self-reliant. She's not going to kowtow or bow before any man at the end of this story. So I removed what I had planned as the final scene, and I just had her in the church giving the Jesus on the cross the thumbs up.
Well, I liked that. I liked that the feminist in you came out, because I thought it was a much more satisfying ending. So I guess sometimes your characters, they can dictate where the story goes.
Totally. Yeah, the characters will take over sometimes. It's bizarre, because you mentioned before Alistair McAllister. It became like a big brother figure for her. Yes. My original notes for the book, she was going to go to the cafe and this character was going to hit on her, and when she turned him down, he was going to be mean to her. That was it. But when he came over, when I was writing it, he started being nice to her. I thought, okay, let's see where this goes.
I loved the character of Alistair. He was such a small character, but I really loved it because it showed her a different side of men. You know, that men can be kind and they can not want anything and they can just actually want to help you.
And a lot of the time too, it's not those big moments that have that impact on the psyche. It is a small moment like that. One random act of kindness, one small moment of kindness.
That can make you rethink and reboot and challenge your ideas. So I actually really liked the character of Alistair, even though he was, like you said, a small character. I think he was powerful in the end.
Yeah, but he wrote himself. He turned up and said, no, I don't want to go.
That's very cool.
I want to come back.
It's like we're going to workshop this. We're workshopping this, John. Just give me 5 minutes. I've got an idea.
How much editing do you do, John? Last question. On your book. Big books. They're not small books. So
look, I always say to my students, like, good writing isn't written, it's rewritten. Mm-hmm. So it's constantly rewriting process. So I have no real plan. I'll probably go over a book 200 times before it goes to my publisher or my agent. So it's a constant revision process. And so I'll go a bit further along and I'll go back to the start. So I'll keep going forward, coming back again, constantly polishing and revising. So that's how it gets done.
It's resilience and persistence.
Persistence is the key word, Danny. You just got to keep at it.
And look, I've read your writing. I'm going to say talent as well. Just take it. Just say thank you.
Thank you. But what I will say is, any talent you have can be extracted through persistence.
I like it.
You think about Edison, genius is 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. And that's so true of writing.
And then I always add the Willy Wonka line about butterscotch ripple. But, it's his idea about invention, which the last part of it is 2% butterscotch ripple. I find that to be a really important thing in my process.
Willy Wonka is important.
It's valuable. It's invaluable.
Absolutely, yeah.
This has been an absolutely fantastic experience to get to talk to you, John, today. It's been wonderful.
Well, thank you both very much. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Danny.
You can find John Larkin on Facebook, Wikipedia, and our website, wordsandnerds.com. For speaking events, contact Nexus Arts or the Children's Bookshop Speaking Agency.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.